want to say one more thing briefly about puberty. Puberty is particularly, I might have already said this, a particularly interesting passage, and that's the first one where the person is conscious as a human being both before and after. And so nature-based societies make a big deal about puberty, actually quite a bigger deal than we do, because it's the first time a human being is going to be conscious of going through a major life passage, and it becomes the conscious template for what it is for the world to change. And so it's a particularly important passage to help the child get it. What is this? This is part of being a human being. Not just to go through this particular passage, but to go through major consciousness-changing passages in life. I don't believe puberty is important because it's the threshold to adulthood. I don't think it is the threshold to adulthood. It's the threshold to adolescence. Okay, so my work over the last 20 years or so has been to help people in that stage of life, which is between confirmation and soul initiation. And it's to say there's a minority of people who ever get to that stage. That's the way I've come to understand what my work is to, and my book Soulcraft is about practices that are used cross-culturally to help people in that stage, which I call the cocoon. The kinds of the things I'll be talking about tomorrow and Sunday, and the kinds of experiential exercises I'm recommending for you, are representative of the kinds of things that are done in the cocoon. They have these exercises have to do with our human wholeness. It has to do with the self, capital S, very similar concept to the way Jung used the term self. And I just want to say briefly about the relationship between doing this kind of work, the cocoon work, between confirmation and soul initiation, the relationship between that and what Joanna Macy has called the Great Turning. How many people know what the Great Turning refers to? Well, Thomas Berry's The Great Work. They're referring to the core work of the 21st century on this planet. And that work is to shift human society from a suicidal, life-destroying, earth-destroying society to a life-sustaining presence on the planet. That's the great work of the Great Turning. I believe the single most important thing that we can do to further the Great Turning is help people go through those two stages, or those two passages, confirmation and soul initiation, because people who've gone through soul initiation have made a commitment to bringing the mystery, their mystery, into the world. And that's where new culture comes from. That's something Thomas Berry tells us, that new culture does not come from thinking up a better way, but it comes from the same place old, healthy cultures come from, which he calls the pre-rational, instinctive level of consciousness, which is the dream or the vision or the revelation. It comes from the mystery. Divide you up into dyads in a moment, but I do first want to say a little bit about answer a question that the planning committee told me that people at this conference like speakers to respond to, and that is, how did I get to doing this work? How did I come to it? So I want to do that without taking too much time. You know, I've been asked that question a lot. I have a whole lot of answers to it. And I asked myself, I knew I was coming here obviously 2 days ago and or 3 days ago, and when I went to sleep that evening, I went to sleep with the question, well, how did I come to this work? I didn't want to use one of my stock answers. And I was half asleep when the answer came to me, and it was really embarrassing. And so I'm going to tell you. The muse answered the question for me. I was half asleep, and she said, girls. And I, of course, I knew immediately what she meant. I was 13 or 14 when I realized that there was something incredibly, bottomlessly, unspeakably mysterious about girls. That there was something that they possessed that was at the very core of their being, which was incredibly alluring for me. And this really wasn't particularly about sex at all. Something incredibly alluring and also ultimately dangerous. And that every girl I met, every girl in my class, embodied this mystery. And nobody talked about it. Parents didn't talk about it, older kids didn't talk about it, kids my age didn't talk about it, girls didn't even talk about it. The books didn't talk about it. Nothing talked about it. When I'd get a girlfriend, I would very shyly, after a while, try to bring up the topic. And as far as I know, none of them knew what I was talking about. But it seemed that they all kind of liked the idea. And some of them even pretended, I think, to know what I was talking about, but they weren't going to tell me. They wanted to know what I had figured out so far, and so they asked me questions about what I thought it was. So that's it. That's how I came to this work, because there were all these mysteries that people weren't talking about. And since then, I've read about nature-based societies, and they know about this stuff. One good example, and if you've read anything by Martine Prechtel, anybody? Martine Prechtel? Long Life, Honey in the Heart? Secrets of the Jaguar? The Disobedience of the Daughter of the Sun? Amazing little book. He's half Native American. He's half Native American, half Swiss, and he was born in New Mexico. When he was 18 or something, he strode deeper into the world, and he strode south, and he got to Guatemala. One of those proverbial moments when he walked into a village and an old man spotted him and said, "What took you so long to get here?" And he became an initiate and eventually became an initiator and a shaman of those people. And he tells us, Martin tells us, that in among their people, the Mayan people, the elders are always out watching the teenagers to see when they start courting. And when they start courting, they know that teenager is ready for the initiation teachings. They just keep waiting. They wait for the young men until they hear them getting particularly eloquent. And then they know it's time. Being a man, he doesn't tell us what was noticed in the young women. He just tells us about the young men. So that's what was missing for me, and I think probably all of us. That kind of thing. What about these mysteries? What is this about? And then by the time I got to college, there were other mysteries revealed to me. I went to college in North Carolina, Duke University, and across the street from the East Campus, which is the women's campus, where I was exploring mysteries there, across the street from the campus was J.B. Rhine's laboratory. He's a famous parapsychologist. I started going over there and meeting these famous psychics who were coming there to be studied. And then I also learned about Zen at that time. Began going to the Zendo. This was in the late 60s. And I also learned about entheogens, which were called psychedelics then. I also started practicing Kundalini yoga. And I joined a Sufi group, and a Gurdjieffian Sufi group. Not necessarily all of them at the same time, but exploring the mysteries. You know, these people and these substances knew something, these plant allies knew something about these mysteries. That got me pretty interested, because nothing else in my religious or cultural background spoke about these things at all. But there were. I just started discovering the mystery schools. And they did speak about these things. However, there was a whole realm of the mysteries none of these schools were talking about. And I didn't know what the difference was, but years later I learned that, in my language anyway, the difference is that between spirit and soul. Zen and yoga and Sufism, to me, was mostly, and my experiences with entheogens were mostly evoking upper world experiences of spirit, of our identity with the universe, our identity with the non-dual, the one. And the darker mysteries were not being spoken to. In college, I read The Hero with a Thousand Faces, and those mysteries weren't being spoken to my knowledge, my understanding, in Zen and later in Tibetan Buddhism, and for me, and Sufism. All this got me very interested. Then in the late 70s, I learned about the work of Stephen Foster and Meredith Little, who are the two people who brought the contemporary vision quest back to our culture. And then I realized that, yes, okay, these people are talking about those kinds of mysteries. If you want to know more about the story, maybe get to that later, or you can catch me at a meal. But what I'd like to ask you to do, before you get much more tired than you are, is to find someone to tell some stories to. If you're sitting right next to the person you live with, you might want to turn around and find someone behind you. And what I want to invite you to do, let yourself be surprised what happens. And I'd like to give you about 5 minutes each. I'll let you know when 5 minutes is up with this chime. Some of you need to go to the restroom. But come back and find someone, and I'd like to invite you to tell a story about wildness in your life. Let me give you some examples of categories. It could be from childhood. It could be mystical moments in a treehouse, or special woods, a ditch, creek, a meadow. It could be something in your youth or your young adulthood. It could be in a religious experience or a spiritual discipline. It could be an encounter in nature of some sort, but some moment when wildness, you encountered wildness, or it encountered you, it enmeshed you, and let yourself just be surprised what comes out of your mouth. Tell a stranger or semi-stranger or maybe even someone you know a story. And your partner can ask you questions to get more of the story, but they can't interpret. Please don't interpret or give advice or categorize or shake your finger. Okay? So do you have the idea of what the assignment is? You may start. If you need to get up and find someone else, please do that. If you haven't finished your story, by all means, finish it later. Make a date to finish that story. Okay, one of my goals this evening is to finish by 9:30, and I think we're going to make it. Just want to give you an overview of the weekend. Saturday and Sunday, we're going to take a look at what I call the nature-based map of the human psyche. And it's my understanding of what nature says totality looks like within the human psyche. It's a map based on the four compass directions. And my hypothesis is that this map covers all the categories of our human wholeness. And hopefully I'll turn out to be wrong and learn more, but that's the hypothesis I'm working with. In particular, tomorrow we're going to take a look at what I call the self. It's similar to what Jung meant by the self, our totality. Even more in particular, we'll be looking at the four dimensions of our wholeness, the four dimensions of the self. Tomorrow. Sunday, we'll look at the four dimensions of our woundedness and the relationship between the self and our woundedness. And on Monday, we'll look at a more fleshed out version of the nature-based stages of human development, of which I only mentioned the passages tonight. much more important than the passages is what happens between them. And we'll look at what happens between them on Monday with an emphasis on the cocoon stage, which I think is the big opportunity for our culture. So there's your overview. And it'll be experiential through dyads, expressive arts. I forgot to mention earlier tonight that the crayons that Ellen mentioned and the drawing pads. I'm encouraging you to bring them into the plenaries with you. And some of you just might find images showing up as during the plenaries, and you might just let yourself be surprised what images show up at the end of your crayon. And then there's these exercises I'm encouraging you to do. Some would be done outside on the land, some can be done inside. And then, of course, there's the small group experiences, a very important part of all of it. I want to suggest two tasks or two exercises that you would do, one tonight and one tomorrow morning. If you're too tired to do it tonight, then do it some other time. But tonight would be better. And if you do it not tonight, it would be better to do it some other time late in the evening, like tomorrow night. And I don't have any assignment for you tomorrow night, so just in case some of you didn't get to this tonight. But if you can't do it tonight or tomorrow night, do it some other time. Late in the evening resonates with what this task is. And then the one for tomorrow morning that's before breakfast, out on the land, resonates with dawn. And that's why it's best to do it at dawn. If you can't do it tomorrow morning, do it Sunday morning. If you can't do it Sunday morning, just do it any time. But it's best at dawn. It works best. So this first one, do you all find that handout in your registration materials that says self-exercises on the upper left? If you didn't, Perry says if you didn't get it, there are extras on the registration table. Okay, it says self-exercises. It's one sheet, two-sided. The one for tonight is the one that says generative adult / nurturing parent. And the one for tomorrow morning is the second one, which is entitled Praise Walk. So that first one, which is generative adult, you have three options. If you don't like the first one, you can do the second one. If you don't like either of those, you can do the third one. Naturally, you'd want to do the one that sounds most challenging. You all knew that, right? Okay, make sure you do the one that's most challenging. If one of these sounds like something you've already done, it probably wouldn't be that challenging to do it again. They're described more fully than I can right now, really. Well, actually, I'll say a few things. The first one is to write a type of love letter to yourself. That is the kind of love letter that a wise, mature, nurturing parent would write to you. Whether you've ever met such a person or had one in your life or not, you have one in your own psyche. So you can write that kind of letter to yourself. That's the one that's explained most fully in your handout. I'll just give you one poem to elaborate on that one. This is a letter of unconditional and fiercely loving support of you from a very mature place. If you have any doubt whether you have that place, this might be a good challenging exercise to do. Here's an example from Derek Walcott, a poem he calls Love After Love. The time will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine. Give wine. Give bread. Give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, "Sit here, eat." You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf. Take them down. Take down the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life. That would be a good exercise, especially if it sounds challenging. The second one, I bet you've never done, and that's to write a love letter from you to the Milky Way. How old are you and you haven't done that yet? Okay, here's an example from Drew Dellinger, the contemporary spoken word poet from the Bay Area. That other Bay, San Francisco Bay. And this is his love letter to the Milky Way. Just to prime the pump here for you. I want to tell you about love. There are approximately 1 trillion galaxies. I want to tell you about, in the Milky Way, there are about 100 billion stars. I want to tell you, love is the breath of the cosmos. I want to write a love letter to the Milky Way. Everything is an expression of the galaxy. My 30 trillion cells, the 4 noble truths, the 8-fold path, the 5 precepts, the 7 energy centers of the body. Everything is the Milky Way, including my lover and every kiss of every lover that's ever lived. The deep sky, the ubiquity of spirit, the DNA of dreams, the interlocking patterns of the cosmic constellations. Cosmos and justice are synonymous with beauty. But parts of the Milky Way don't give off light. Sometimes it feels like I've got ground zero in my heart. The dark sun bleeds shadows. The dark sun leaves shadows on everything. The forecast calls for scattered to broken skies. If there wasn't so much love, there wouldn't be so much pain. It's like love is the nervous system of the universe, bringing us joy and sorrow. I inherit the voice of the Milky Way in my dreams. The entire galaxy revolves around a single drop of wine. Your skin, the texture of the cosmos, the religion beyond religion. I want to know you like the wind knows the canyons, or the rain knows the rivulets. Lightning is continuously striking in 100 places every moment. The universe spills through our dreams. The future belongs to the most compelling story. Even the word love is not adequate to define the force that that wove the fabric of space-time. Even the word love is not adequate to define the force that wove the fabric of space-time. If we could sense everything at once, like Krishna entering history with all the memory of his past incarnations, then I could tell you about love. Maybe that will inspire some of you to write a love letter to the Milky Way. Your third option, don't say I didn't give you options, for tonight would be to write a vow of commitment to enacting or deepening your soul work. Simple enough. Write a vow of commitment to enacting or deepening your soul work. It could be a promise it would kill you to break. For tonight. No, I meant that's it for your assignment tonight. But one last thing for me tonight is to say something about tomorrow morning's assignment. Sorry. And that's a praise walk before breakfast, or right after breakfast before the meeting. If you can, you know, get at least 15 minutes there before breakfast and go for a walk. This is described on the handout. And the assignment essentially is to go for a walk and to praise everything you encounter in nature that is praiseworthy to you. And to praise it out loud or with movement or both. Not just with still, silent appreciation. To praise with sound, which can be verbal sound or chanting or speaking in tongues or song. Or movement, dance, gesture. Lebanon Valley College campus needs you to do this. Okay, there's more specifics on your handout, and here's just a poem. This is the best praise walk poem I've ever come across. It's Mary Oliver's. It's actually on your handout. She says, this is called Mindful. Mindful. Every day I see or hear something that more or less kills me with delight. Every day I see or hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. It was what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world. To instruct myself over and over in joy and acclamation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, the fearful, the dreadful, the very extravagant, no, but of the ordinary, the common, the very drab, the daily presentations. Oh, good scholar, I say to myself, how can you help but grow wise with such teachings as these? The untrimmable light of the world, the oceans shine, the prayers that are made out of grass. That is it for me for tonight, and we'll see you tomorrow morning. Have a good night.